was too refined for the mere deceiving of accidental predators, feathered, scaled, and otherwise, not very fastidious, but then not too fond of butterflies, and seemed to have been invented by some waggish artist precisely for the intelligent eyes of man. A hypothesis that may lead far an evolutionist who observes apes feeding on butterflies. He told me about these magic masks of mimicry, about the enormous moth which in a state of repose assumes the image of a snake looking at you, of a tropical geometrid colored in perfect imitation of a species of butterfly infinitely removed from it in nature's system, the illusion of the orange underside possessed by one being humorously reproduced in the other by the orange-colored inner margins of the secondaries, and about the curious harem of that famous African swallowtail, whose variously disguised females copy in color, shape, and even flight half a dozen different species, apparently inedible, which are also the models of numerous other mimics. He told me about migrations, about the long cloud consisting of myriads of white pyrids that moves through the sky, indifferent to the direction of the wind, always at the same level above the ground, rising softly and smoothly over hills and sinking again into valleys, meeting perhaps another cloud of butterflies, yellow, filtering through it without stopping and without soiling its own whiteness, and floating further to settle on trees toward nighttime, which stand until morning as if bestrewn with snow, and then taking off again to continue their journey. Whither? Why? A tale not yet finished by nature, or else forgotten. Our thistle butterfly, he said, the painted lady of the English, the belle dame of the French, does not hibernate in Europe as related species do. It is born on the African plains. There, at dawn, the lucky traveller may hear the whole steppe, glistening in the first rays, crackle with an incalculable number of hatching chrysalids. From there, without delay, it begins its journey north, reaching the shores of Europe in early spring, suddenly enlivening the gardens of the Crimea and the terraces of the Riviera. Without lingering, but leaving individuals everywhere for summer breeding, it proceeds further north, and by the end of May, by now in single specimens, it reaches Scotland, Heligoland, our parts, and even the extreme north of the earth. It has been caught in Iceland. With a strange, crazy flight, unlike anything else, the bleached, hardly recognizable butterfly, choosing a dry glade, wheels in and out of the Leschino firs, and by the end of the summer, on thistle heads, on asters, its lovely pink-flushed offspring is already reveling in life. Most moving of all, added my father, is that on the first cold days a reverse phenomenon is observed, the ebb. The butterfly hastens southward for the winter, but of course it perishes before it reaches the warmth. Simultaneously with the Englishman Tut, who observed the same thing in the Swiss Alps as he in the Pamirs, my father discovered the true nature of the corneal formation appearing beneath the abdomen in the impregnated females of Parnassians, and explained how her mate, working with a pair of spatulate appendages, places and molds on her a chastity belt of his own manufacture, shaped differently in every species of this genus, being sometimes a little boat, sometimes a helical shell, sometimes, as in the case of the exceptionally rare dark cinder gray Orpheus Godunov, a replica of a tiny lyre. And as a frontispiece to my present work, I think I would like to display precisely this butterfly. For I can hear him talk about it, can see the way he took the six specimens he had brought back out of their six thick triangular envelopes, the way he lowered his eyes with the field magnifier close to the abdomen of the only female, and how reverently his laboratory assistant relaxed in a damp jar the dry, glossy, tightly folded wings, in order later to drive a pin smoothly through the insect's thorax, stick it in the cork groove of the spreading board, hold down flat upon it by means of broad strips of semi-transparent paper its open, defenseless, gracefully expanded beauty, then slip a bit of cotton wool under its abdomen and straighten its black antennae so that it dried that way forever. Forever? In the Berlin Museum, there are many of my father's captures, and these are as fresh today as they were in the 80s and 90s. Butterflies from Linnaeus's collection, now in London, have subsisted since the 18th century. In the Prague Museum, one can see that same example of the showy Atlas moth that Catherine the Great admired. Why then do I feel so sad? His captures, his observations, the sound of his voice and scientific words, all this I think I will preserve. But that is still so little. With the same relative permanence, I would like to retain what it was, perhaps, that I loved most of all about him. His live masculinity, inflexibility, and independence. The chill and the warmth of his personality, his power over everything that he undertook. As if playing a game, as if wishing in passing to imprint his force on everything, he would pick out here and there something from a field outside entomology, and thus he left his mark upon almost all branches of natural science. There is only one plant described by him out of all those he collected, but that one is a spectacular species of birch. One bird, a most fabulous pheasant. One bat, but the biggest one in the world. And in all parts of nature, our name echoes a countless number of times. For other naturalists gave his name either to a spider, or to a rhododendron, or to a mountain ridge. The latter, by the way, made him angry. To ascertain and preserve the ancient native name of a pass, he wrote, is always both more scientific and more noble than to saddle it with the name of a good acquaintance. I only now understood how much I liked it, that special easy knack he showed in dealing with a horse, a dog, a gun, a bird, or a peasant boy with a 2-inch splinter in his back. He was constantly being brought people who were wounded, maimed, even infirm, even pregnant women, who probably took his mysterious occupation for voodoo practice. I liked the fact that, in contradistinction to the majority of non-Russian travelers, Sven Hedin, for example, he never changed his clothes for Chinese ones on his wanderings. In general, he kept aloof, was severe and resolute in the extreme in his relations with the natives, showing no indulgence to mandarins and lamas. And in camp, he practiced shooting, which served as an excellent precaution against any importuning. He was entirely uninterested in ethnography, a fact that for some reason greatly irritated certain geographers, and his great friend, the Orientalist Krivtsov, almost wept when reproaching him. If only you had brought back one wedding song, Konstantin Kirillovich, had described one local dress. There was one professor at Kazan who attacked him especially. Proceeding from some sort of humanitarian liberal premises, he convicted him of scientific aristocratism, of a haughty contempt for man, of disregard for the reader's interests, of dangerous eccentricity, and of much more. And once, at an international banquet in London, and this episode pleases me most of all, Sven Hedin, sitting next to my father, asked him how it had happened that, traveling with unprecedented freedom over the forbidden parts of Tibet in the immediate vicinity of Lhasa, he had not gone to look at it. To which my father replied that he had not wanted to sacrifice even 1 hour's collecting for the sake of visiting one more filthy little town. And I can see so clearly how his eyes must have narrowed as he spoke. He was endowed with an even temper, self-control, strong willpower, and a vivid sense of humor. But when he became angry, his wrath was like a sudden stroke of frost. Grandmother said behind his back, "All the clocks in the house stopped." And I can well remember those sudden silences at table and the kind of absent-minded look that immediately appeared on Mother's face. Ill-wishers among our female kin maintained that she trembled before Kostya, and how one of the governesses at the end of the table would hastily place her palm on a glass which was on the point of tinkling. The cause of his wrath could be a blunder by someone, a miscomputation by the steward. Father was well versed in the estate affairs. A flippant remark made about an intimate of his, trite political sentiments in the spirit of soapbox patriotism brought out by some ill-starred guest, or, finally, some misdemeanor or other of mine. He who in his time had slaughtered countless multitudes of birds, he who had once brought the newlywed botanist Berg the complete vegetable covering of a motley little mountain meadow in one piece, the size of a room in area, I imagined it rolled up in a case like a Persian carpet, which he had found somewhere at some fantastic height among bare cliffs and snow, he could not forgive me a Leschino sparrow wantonly shot down with a Monte Cristo rifle, or the young pond-side aspen I had slashed with a sword. He could not stand procrastination, hesitation, the blinking eyes of a lie, could not stand hypocrisy or syrupiness. And I'm sure that had he caught me out in physical cowardice, he would have laid a curse on me. I've not said everything yet. I'm coming up to what is perhaps most important. In and around my father, around this clear and direct strength, there was something difficult to convey in words, a haze, a mystery, an enigmatic reserve which made itself felt sometimes more, sometimes less. It was as if this genuine, very genuine man possessed an aura of something still unknown, but which was perhaps the most genuine of all. It had no direct connection either with us or with my mother or with the externals of life or even with butterflies, the closest of all to him, I dare say. It was neither pensiveness nor melancholy. And I have no means of explaining the impression his face made on me when I looked through his study window from outside and saw how, having suddenly forgotten his work, I could feel inside me how he had forgotten it, as if something had fallen through or trailed off. His large, wise head turned slightly away from the desk and resting on his fist, so that a wide crease was raised from his cheek to his temple, he sat for a minute without moving. It sometimes seems to me nowadays that, who knows, he might go off on his journeys, not so much to seek something as to flee something, and that on returning, he would realize that it was still with him, inside him, unriddable, inexhaustible. I cannot track down a name for his secret, but I only know that that was the source of that, the special, neither glad nor morose, having indeed no connection with the outward appearance of human emotions, solitude, to which neither my mother nor all the entomologists of the world had any admittance. And strange, perhaps the estate watchman, a crooked old man who had twice been singed by night lightning, the sole person among our rural retainers who had learned without my father's help, who had taught it to a whole regiment of Asian hunters, to catch and kill a butterfly without mangling it, which of course did not stop him advising me with a businesslike air not to be in a hurry to catch small butterflies, tiddlers, as he expressed it, in spring, but to wait till summer when they would have grown up. Namely, he, who frankly and with no fear or surprise considered that my father knew a thing or two that nobody else knew, was in his own way right. However that may have been, I'm convinced now that our life then really was imbued with a magic unknown in other families. From conversations with my father, from daydreams in his absence, from the neighborhood of thousands of books full of drawings of animals, from the precious shimmer of the collections, from the maps, from all the heraldry of nature and the cabalism of Latin names, life took on a kind of bewitching lightness that made me feel as if my own travels were about to begin. Thence I borrow my wings today. Among the old, tranquil, velvet-framed family photographs in my father's study, there hung a copy of the picture Marco Polo Leaving Venice. She was rosy, this Venice, and the water of her lagoon was azure, with swans twice the size of the boats, into one of which tiny violet men were descending by way of a plank in order to board a ship which was waiting a little way off with sails furled. And I cannot tear myself away from this mysterious beauty. These ancient colors which swim before the eyes as if seeking new shapes. When I now imagine the outfitting of my father's caravan in Przewalsk, where he used to go with post-horses from Tashkent, having dispatched in advance by slow convoy a store of supplies for 3 years. His Cossacks went round the neighboring villages buying horses, mules, and camels. They prepared the pack boxes and pouches. What was there not in these sartish yagtans and leather bags tried by centuries, from cognac to pulverized peas, from ingots of silver to nails for horseshoes? And after a requiem on the shore of the lake by the burial rock of the explorer Przewalski, crowned with a bronze eagle, around which the intrepid local pheasants were wont to roost, the caravan took the road. After that, I see the caravan, before it gets drawn into the mountains, winding among hills of a paradisean green shade, depending both on their grassy raiment and on the apple-bright epidotic rock of which they are composed. The compact, sturdy Kalmuk ponies walk in single file, forming echelons. The paired pack loads of equal weight are seized twice with lariats so that nothing can shift, and a Cossack leads every echelon by the bridle. In front of the caravan, a Berdan rifle over his shoulder and a butterfly net at the ready, wearing spectacles and a nankeen blouse, father rides on his white trotter, accompanied by a native horseman. Closing the detachment comes the geodesist Kunitsin. This is the way I see it. A majestic old man who has spent half a lifetime in imperturbable wanderings, with his instruments in cases, chronometers, surveying compasses, and artificial horizon. And when he stops to take a bearing or to note down azimuths in his journal, his horse is held by an assistant, a small anemic German, Ivan Ivanovich Viskot, formerly chemist at Gatchina, whom my father had once taught to prepare bird skins, and who took part from then on in all the expeditions, until he died of gangrene in the summer of 1903 in Dinku. Further, I see the mountains, the Tian Shan range. In search of passes, marked on the map according to oral data, but first explored by my father, the caravan ascended over steep slopes and narrow ledges, slipped down to the north, to the steppe teeming with saigas, ascended again to the south, here fording torrents, there trying to get across high water, and up, up, along almost impassable trails. How the sunlight played! The dryness of the air produced an amazing contrast between light and shadow. In the light, there were such flashes, such a wealth of brilliance, that at times it became impossible to look at a rock, at a stream. And in the shadow, a darkness which absorbed all detail, so that every color lived a magically multiplied life, and the coats of the horses changed as they entered the cool of the poplars. The boom of water in the gorge was enough to stun a man, head and breast filled with an electric agitation. The water rushed with awesome force, as smooth, however, as molten lead, then suddenly swelled out monstrously as it reached the rapids, its varicolored waves piling up and falling over the lustrous brows of the stones with a furious roar, and then, crashing from a height of 20 feet out of a rainbow and into darkness, it ran further, now changed, seething, smoke-blue and snow-like from the foam. It struck first one side and then the other of the conglomeratic canyon in such a way that it seemed the reverberating mountain fastness could never withstand it. On its banks, meanwhile, in blissful quiet, the irises were in bloom. And suddenly, a herd of morels dashed out of a black fir wood onto a dazzling alpine meadow and halted, quivering. No, it was only the air quivering. They had already vanished. I can conjure up with particular clarity, in this transparent and changeable setting, my father's principal and constant occupation, the occupation for whose only sake he undertook these tremendous journeys. I see him leaning down from the saddle, amid a clatter of sliding stones, to sweep in with a swing of his net on the end of its long handle, a twist of the wrist causing the end of the muslin bag, full of rustling and throbbing, to flip across the ring, thus preventing escape, some royal relative of our Apollos, which had been skimming with a ranging flight over the dangerous screes. And not only he, but also the other riders, the Cossack Corporal Semyon Zharkoy, for example, or the Buryat Buyantuyev, or else that representative of mine whom I sent in the wake of my father throughout my boyhood, work their way fearlessly up the rocks in pursuit of the white, richly oscillated butterfly which they catch at last. And here it is in my father's fingers, dead, its hairy, yellowish, incurved body resembling a willow catkin, and the glazy underside of its crisp, folded wings showing the blood-red maculation at their roots. He avoided dawdling in Chinese roadhouses, especially overnight, because he disliked them for their bustle devoid of feeling that consisted solely of shouting without the slightest hint of laughter. But, strangely enough, in his memory later, the smell of these inns, that special air belonging to any place where Chinese dwell, a rancid mixture of kitchen fumes, smoke from burned manure, opium, and the stable, spoke more to him of his beloved hunting than the recollected fragrancy of mountain meadows. Moving across the Tian Shan with the caravan, I can now see evening approaching, drawing a shadow over the mountain slopes. Postponing until the morning a difficult crossing, a ramshackle bridge has been thrown across the turbulent river, consisting of stone slabs on top of brushwood, but the way up on the other side is steepish and moreover as smooth as glass, the caravan settles down for the night. While the colors of sunset still linger in the aerial tiers of the sky, and supper is being prepared, the Cossacks, having first taken off the animal's sweat cloths and felt under blankets, wash the wounds made by the packs. In the darkling air, the clear ring of shoeing resounds above the ample noise of water. It has grown quite dark. Father has climbed a rock looking for a place to suit his calcium lamp for catching moths. Thence one can see in Chinese perspective, from above, in a deep gully, the redness, transparent in the darkness, of the campfire. Through the edges of its breathing flame seem to float the broad-shouldered shadows of men, endlessly changing their outlines, and a red reflection trembles without moving from the spot on the seething water of the river. But above, all is quiet and dark. Only rarely does a bell tinkle. The horses, who have already stood to receive their portion of dry fodder, are now roaming among the granite debris. Overhead, frighteningly and entrancingly close, the stars have come out, each conspicuous, each a live orbicle, clearly revealing its globular essence. Moths begin to come to the lure of the lamp. They describe crazy circles around it, hitting the reflector with a ping. They fall. They crawl over the spread sheet into the circle of light. Gray, with eyes like burning coals, vibrating, flying up and falling again. And a large, brightly illumined, unhurriedly skillful hand, with almond-shaped fingernails, rakes noctuid after noctuid into the killing jar. Sometimes he was quite alone, without even this nearness of men sleeping in camp tents, on felt mattresses, around the camel bedded down on the campfire ashes. Taking advantage of lengthy halts in places with abundant food for the caravan animals, Father would go away for several days on reconnaissance, and in doing so, carried away by some new pirid, more than once ignored the rule of mountain hunting, never to follow a path of no return. And now I continually ask myself, what did he used to think about in the solitary night? I try fervently in the darkness to divine the current of his thoughts, and I have much less success with this than with my mental visits to places which I have never seen. What did he think about? About a recent catch? About my mother? About us? About the innate strangeness of human life, a sense of which he mysteriously transmitted to me? Or perhaps I'm wrong in retrospectively forcing upon him the secret which he carries now, when, newly gloomy and preoccupied, concealing the pain of an unknown wound, concealing death as something shameful, he appears in my dreams, but which then he did not have, but simply was happy in that incompletely named world in which at every step he named the nameless. After spending the whole summer in the mountains, not one summer, but several, in different years, which are superimposed one on another in translucent layers, our caravan moved east through a gulch into a stony desert. We saw gradually disappear both the bed of the stream as it split and fanned out, and those plants that to the last remain faithful to travelers, stunted amodendrons, lasiogrostis, and ephedras. Having loaded the camels with water, we plunged into spectral wilds where here and there big pebbles covered completely the yielding reddish-brown clay of the desert, in places mottled with crusts of dirty snow and outcrops of salt, which we took in the distance for the walls of the town we sought. The way was dangerous as a result of the terrible storms, during which at midday everything was blanketed in a salty brown fog. The wind roared, granules of gravel lashed one's face, the camels lay down, and our tarpaulin tent was torn to shreds. Because of these storms, the surface of the land has changed unbelievably, presenting the fantastic outlines of castles, colonnades, and staircases. Or else the hurricane would scour out a hollow, as if here in this desert the elemental forces that had fashioned the world were still furiously in action. But there were also days of a wonderful lull, when horned larks, father aptly called them gigglers, poured forth their mimetic trills, and flocks of ordinary sparrows accompanied our emaciated animals. On occasion, we would pass the day in isolated settlements consisting of two or three homesteads and a ruined temple. At other times, we would be attacked by Tunguts in sheepskin coats and red and blue woolen boots, a brief, colorful episode on the way. And then there were the mirages. The mirages where nature, that exquisite cheat, achieved absolute miracles. Visions of water were so clear that they reflected the real rocks nearby. Further came the quiet sands of the Gobi. Dune after dune went by like waves revealing short ochre horizons. And all that was audible in the velvet air was the labored, quickened breathing of the camels and the scrape of their broad feet. The caravan went onward, now ascending to the crest of a dune, now plunging downward, and by evening its shadow had attained gigantic proportions. The 5-carat diamond of Venus disappeared in the west, together with the glow of the sunset, which distorted everything in its blanched orange and violet light. And Father loved to recall how once at such a sunset in 1893, in the dead heart of the Gobi Desert, he had met with, taking them at first for phantoms projected by the prismatic rays, 2 cyclists in Chinese sandals and round felt hats, who turned out to be the Americans Sachtleben and Allen, riding all across Asia to Peking for fun. Spring awaited us in the mountains of Nanshan. Everything foretold it, the babbling of the water in the brooks, the distant thunder of the rivers, the whistle of the creepers which lived in holes on the slippery wet hillsides, the delightful singing of the local larks, and a mass of noises whose origins are hard to explain. A phrase from the notes of a friend of my father's, Grigory Yefimovich Grumgzhimailo, which is fixed in my mind forever, and full of the amazing music of truth, because written not by an ignorant poet, but by a naturalist of genius. On the southern slopes, We had already met our first interesting butterfly, Potanin's subspecies of Butler's pierid. And in the valley to which we descended by way of a torrent bed, we found real summer. All the slopes were studded with anemones and primulae. Przewalski's gazelle and Strauch's pheasant tempted the hunters. And what sunrises there were! Only in China is the early mist so enchanting, causing everything to vibrate, the fantastic outlines of hovels, the dawning crags. As into an abyss, the river runs into the murk of the prematutinal twilight that still hangs in the gorges, while higher up, along flowing waters, all glimmers and scintillates, and quite a company of blue magpies has already awakened in the willows by the mill. Escorted by 15 Chinese foot soldiers armed with halberds and carrying enormous, absurdly bright banners, we crossed passes through the ridge a number of times. In spite of it being the middle of summer, night frosts were so bad there that in the morning the flowers were filmed with rime and had become so brittle that they snapped underfoot with a surprising, gentle tinkle. But 2 hours later, just as soon as the sun began to be warm, the wonderful alpine flora again resplended, again scented the air with resin and honey. Clinging to steep banks, we made our way under the hot blue sky. Grasshoppers shot from under our feet. The dogs ran with their tongues hanging out, seeking refuge from the heat in the short shadows thrown by the horses. The water in the wells smelled of gunpowder. The trees seemed to be a botanist's delirium. A white rowan with alabaster berries, or a birch with red bark. Placing one foot on a fragment of rock and leaning slightly on the handle of his net, my father looks down from a high spur, from the glacier boulders of Tanegma, at the lake Kukanor, a huge spread of dark blue water. There, down below on the golden steps, a herd of kyangs rushes past. And the shadow of an eagle flicks across the cliffs. Overhead, there is perfect peace, silence, transparency. And again I ask myself what father is thinking about when he is not busy collecting and stands there like that, quite still, appearing, as it were, on the crest of my recollection, torturing me, enrapturing me to the point of pain. To an insanity of tenderness, envy, and love, tormenting my soul with his inscrutable solitariness. There were the times when going up the Yellow River and its tributaries on some splendid September morning, in the lily thickets and hollows on the banks, he and I would take Elvis's swallowtail, a black wonder with tails in the shape of hooves. On inclement evenings, before sleeping, he would read Horace, Montaigne, and Pushkin, the three books he had brought with him. One winter, when crossing the ice of a river, I noticed in the distance a line of dark objects strung across it, the large horns of 20 wild yaks, which had been caught in crossing by the suddenly forming ice. Through its thick crystal, the immobilization of their bodies in a swimming attitude was clearly visible. The beautiful heads, lifted above the ice, would have seemed alive if the birds had not already pecked out their eyes. And for some reason, I recalled the tyrant Shusin, who used to cut open pregnant women out of curiosity, and who one cold morning, seeing some porters fording a stream, ordered their legs to be amputated at the shin in order to inspect the condition of the marrow in their bones. In Chang, during a fire, some wood prepared for the construction of a Catholic mission was burning, I saw an elderly Chinese at a safe distance from the fire throwing water assiduously, determinately, and without tiring, over the reflection of the flames on the walls of his dwelling. Convinced of the impossibility of proving to him that his house was not burning, we abandoned him to his fruitless occupation. Frequently we had to push our way through, ignoring Chinese intimidation and interdictions. Good marksmanship is the best passport. In Taxianlu, Shaven-headed llamas roamed about the crooked, narrow streets, spreading the rumor that I was catching children in order to brew their eyes into a potion for the belly of my Kodak. There, on the slopes of a snowy range, which were drowned in the rich, rosy foam of great rhododendrons, we used their branches at night for our campfires, I looked in May for the slate-gray, orange-spotted larvae of the imperatorial Apollo, and for its chrysalis, fastened by means of a silk thread to the underside of a stone. That same day, I remember, we glimpsed a white Tibetan bear and discovered a new snake. It fed on mice, and the mouse I extracted from its stomach also turned out to be an undescribed species. From the rhododendrons and from the pines draped in lacy lichen came a heady smell of resin. In my vicinity, some witch doctors, with the wary and crafty look of competitors, were collecting for their mercenary needs Chinese rhubarb, whose root bears an extraordinary resemblance to a caterpillar, right down to its prolegs and spiracles. While I, in the meantime, found under a stone the caterpillar of an unknown moth, which represented not in a general way, but with absolute concreteness, a copy of that root, so that it was not quite clear which was impersonating which, or why. Everyone tells lies in Tibet. It was devilishly hard to obtain the exact names of places or directions for the right roads. Involuntarily, I too deceived them, since they were unable to distinguish a light-haired European from a white-haired one. They took me, a young chap with hair bleached in the sun, for an ancient old man. Everywhere on the masses of granite, one could read the mystic formula, a shamanic jumble of words which certain poetic travelers translate prettily as, "O jewel in the lotus, O." Some kind of officials were sent out to me from Lhasa, who conjured me not to do something and threatened to do something to me. I paid little attention to them. However, I remember one idiot, particularly tiresome, in yellow silk under a red umbrella. He was sitting astride a mule whose natural dolefulness was doubled by the presence under its eyes of thick icicles formed from frozen tears. From a great height, I saw a dark, marshy depression all trembling from the play of innumerable springs, which recalled the night sky with stars scattered over it. And that is what it was called, the Starry Steppe. The passes ascended beyond the clouds. Marches were tough. We rubbed the pack animal's wounds with a mixture of iodoform and Vaseline. On occasion, having camped in a completely deserted spot, I would suddenly see in the morning that around us during the night a wide circle of brigands' tents had grown up like black toadstools, which, however, very quickly disappeared. Having explored the uplands of Tibet, I headed for Lop Nor in order to return from there to Russia. The Tarim, overcome by the desert, exhausted, forms with its last waters an extensive reedy swamp, the present-day Karakoshuk Kul, Przewalski's Lop Nor, and Lop Nor at the time of the Khans, whatever Richthofen might say. It is fringed with salt marshes, but the water is salt only at the edges, for those rushes would not grow around a salt lake. One spring I was 5 days going round it. There, in 20-foot-high reeds, I had the luck to discover a remarkable semi-aquatic moth with a rudimentary system of veins. The bunchy salt marsh was strewn with the shells of mollusks. In the evenings, the harmonious melodic sounds of swan flights reverberated through the silence. The yellow of the rushes distinctly brought out the lusterless white of the birds. In 1862, 60 Russian old believers with their wives and children lived for half a year in these parts, after which they went to Turfan, and where they went thence, nobody knows. Further on comes the desert of Lob, a stony plain, tiers of clay precipices, glassy salt ponds. That pale fleck in the gray air is a lone individual of Roborovsky's white, carried away by the wind. In this desert are preserved traces of an ancient road along which Marco Polo passed 6 centuries before I did. Its markers are piles of stones. Just as I had heard in a Tibetan gorge the interesting drum-like roar which had frightened our first pilgrims, so in the desert during the sandstorms I also saw and heard the same as Marco Polo, the whisper of spirits calling you aside, and the queer flicker of the air, an endless progression of whirlwinds, caravans and armies of phantoms coming to meet you, thousands of spectral faces in their incorporeal way pressing upon you, through you, and suddenly dispersing. In the 20s of the 14th century, when the great explorer was dying, his friends gathered by his bedside and implored him to reject what in his book had seemed incredible to them, to water down its miracles by means of judicious deletions. But he responded that he had not recounted even a half of what he had in fact seen. All this lingered bewitchingly, full of color and air, with lively movement in the foreground and a convincing backdrop. Then, like smoke from a breeze, it shifted and dispersed. And Fyodor saw again the dead and impossible tulips of his wallpaper, the crumbling mound of cigarette butts in the ashtray, and the lamp's reflection in the black window pane. He threw open the window. The written-up sheets of paper on his desk started. One folded over, another glided onto the floor. The room immediately turned damp and cold. Down below, an automobile went slowly along the dark, empty street. And strangely enough, this very slowness reminded Fyodor of a host of petty, unpleasant things. The day just passed, the mist lessened. And when he thought that next morning he would have to phone the deceived old man, his heart was oppressed by an abominable despondency. But once the window was closed again, already feeling the void between his bunched fingers, he turned to the patiently waiting lamp, to the scattered first drafts, to the still warm pen which now quietly slipped back into his fingers, explaining the void and filling it, and returned at once to that world which was as natural to him as snow to the white hair or water to Ophelia. He remembered with incredible vividness, as if he had preserved that sunny day in a velvet case, his father's last return, in July 1912. Elizaveta Pavlovna had already gone the 6 miles to the station to meet her husband. She always met him alone, and it always happened that no one knew with any clearness which side they would return on, to the right or left of the house, since there were two roads, one longer and smoother along the highway and through the village, the other shorter and bumpier through Peschanka. Fyodor put on his riding breeches just in case and ordered his horse saddled, but nonetheless he could not make up his mind to ride out and meet his father because he was afraid of missing him. He tried vainly to come to terms with inflated, exaggerated time. A rare butterfly taken a day or two before among the blueberries of a peat bog had not yet dried on the spreading board. He kept touching its abdomen with the end of a pin. Alas, it was still soft, and this meant it was impossible to take off the paper strips completely covering the wings, which he was so keen to show his father in all their beauty. He loafed about the manor, feeling the weight and pain of his agitation, and envying the way the others got through these big, empty minutes. From the river came the desperately ecstatic shrieks of the village boys bathing, and this hubbub, playing constantly in the depths of the summer day, sounded like distant ovations. Tanya was swinging enthusiastically and powerfully on the swing in the garden, standing on the seat. The violet shadow of the foliage swept over her flying white skirt in variegations that made one blink, and her blouse now lagged behind, now clung to her back, designating the hollow between her drawn-back shoulders. Beneath her, one fox terrier was barking at her, another was chasing a wagtail. The ropes creaked joyfully, and it seemed that Tanya was soaring up like that in order to see over the trees into the road. Our French governess, under her moire parasol, with rare politeness, was sharing her misgivings, the train was 2 hours late or else would not come at all, with Mr. Browning, whom she hated, while the latter stood slapping his gaiters with a riding stick. He was no polyglot. Ivona Ivanovna kept visiting first one and then the other veranda with that discontented expression on her small face with which she greeted all joyful events. Around the outbuildings, there was a special animation. Servants pumped water, hacked firewood, and the gardener came bringing two oblong red-stained baskets of strawberries. Jaksibai, an elderly Kyrgyz, thick-set, fat-faced, with intricate wrinkles around his eyes, who had saved Konstantin Kirillovich's life in 92, he had shot a she-bear that was mauling him, and who now lived in peace, nursing his hernia, in their Leshino house, had put on his blue beshmet with half-moon pockets, polished boots, red skull cap with spangles and silk, tasseled sash, and settled down on a bench near the kitchen porch, where by now he had been sitting for quite a time sunning himself, a silver watch chain gleaming on his chest in quiet and festive expectation. Suddenly, running heavily up the curved path which led down to the river, there appeared out of deep shadow with a wild glint in his eyes and with a mouth that was already shaped for a shout, though still silent, the old gray side-whiskered footman, Kazimir. He was running with the news that beyond the nearest bend, the sound of hooves had been heard on the bridge, a swift wooden drumming which was immediately cut off, a guarantee that the Victoria was about to come bowling next minute along the dirt road parallel to the park. Fyodor rushed in that direction, between the tree trunks over the moss and bilberries, and there, beyond the marginal path, one could see, as they skimmed above the level of the young firs, the driver's head and indigo sleeve sweeping by with the impetuosity of a vision. He dashed back, and the abandoned swing was still quivering in the garden, while by the porch stood the empty Victoria with its crumpled traveling rug. His mother was walking up the steps, trailing behind her a smoke-colored scarf, and Tanya was hanging on the neck of her father, who had taken a watch from his pocket with his free hand, and was looking at it, for he always liked to know how fast he had got home from the station. The following year, busy with scientific work, he did not go anywhere. But by the spring of 1914, he had already begun to prepare for a new expedition to Tibet, together with the ornithologist Petrov and the English botanist Ross. War with Germany suddenly cancelled all this. He looked upon the war as a tiresome obstacle which became more and more tiresome as time went on. His kinsfolk were for some reason certain that Konstantin Kirillovich would volunteer and set off right away at the head of a detachment. They considered him an eccentric, but a manly eccentric. Actually, Konstantin Kirillovich, who was now over 50, but had retained untapped reserves of health, agility, freshness, and strength, and perhaps was even more ready than before to overcome mountains, Tunguts, bad weather, and a thousand other dangers undreamt of by stay-at-homes, now not only stayed at home, but tried not to notice the war. And if he ever spoke about it, he did so only with angry contempt. "My father," wrote Fyodor, recalling that time, "not only taught me a great deal, but also trained my very thoughts, as a voice or hand is trained, according to the rules of his school. Thus, I was rather indifferent to the cruelty of war. I even conceded that one could take a certain delicacy in the accuracy of a shot, in the danger of a reconnaissance, or in the delicacy of a maneuver. But these little pleasures, which are better represented, moreover, in other special branches of sport, such as tiger hunting, noughts and crosses, professional boxing, in no way compensated for that touch of dismal idiocy which is inherent in any war." However, in spite of Kostya's unpatriotic position, as Aunt Ksenia expressed it, solidly and skillfully using high connections to hide her officer husband away in the shadows of the rear, the house was penetrated by the cares of war. Elizaveta Pavlovna was drawn into Red Cross work, which had people comment that her energy was making up for her husband's idleness, he being more concerned with Asian bugs than with the glory of Russian arms, as was actually pointed out, by the way, in one jaunty newspaper. Phonograph records revolved with the words of the love song, "The Seagull," reclad in khaki. Here's a young ensign with an infantry section. Coy nurses appeared in the house with little curls peeping out from under their regulation headdress and a deft way of tapping cigarettes on their cigarette cases before lighting up. The doorkeeper's son ran away to the front, and Konstantin Kirillovich was asked to assist his return. Tanya began visiting her mother's military hospital to give Russian grammar lessons to a placid, bearded Oriental whose leg was being cut off ever higher in an attempt to overtake the gangrene. Ivona Ivanovna knit woolen wrist warmers. On holidays, the variety artist Fiona entertained the soldiers with vaudeville songs. The hospital staff staged Vova Makes the Best of It, a play on draft dodgers, and the newspapers printed versicles dedicated to the war. Today thou art fate's scourge o'er our dear land, but with bright joy the Russian's gaze will shine when he sees time dispassionately brand the German Attila with shame's own sign. In the spring of 1915, instead of getting ready to move from St. Petersburg to Leshino, which always seemed as natural and unshakable as the succession of months in the calendar, we went for the summer to our Crimean estate, on the coast between Yalta and Alupka. On the sloping lawns of the heavenly green garden, his face distorted with anguish, his hands trembling with happiness, Fyodor boxed southern butterflies. But the genuine Crimean rarities were to be found not here among the myrtles, wax shrubs, and magnolias, but much higher in the mountains, among the rocks of Aipetri and on the grassy plateau of the Yaila. More than once that summer, his father accompanied him up a trail through the pine woods in order to show him, with a smile of condescension for this European trifle, the satyrid recently described by Kuznetsov, which was flitting from stone to stone in the very place where some vulgar daredevil had carved his name in the sheer rock. These walks were Konstantin Kirillovich's only distraction. It was not that he was gloomy or irritable. These limited epithets did not tally with his spiritual style, but that, putting it simply, he was fretting. And Elizaveta Pavlovna and the children were perfectly aware of what it was he wanted. Suddenly, in August, he went away for a short time. Where he went, no one except those closest to him knew. He covered up his journey so thoroughly as to excite the envy of any traveling terrorist. It was funny and frightening to imagine how Russian public opinion would have wrung its little hands had it learned that at the height of the war, Godunov Cherdintsev had traveled to Geneva to meet a fat, bald, extraordinarily jovial German professor. A third conspirator was also present, an old Englishman wearing thin-rimmed spectacles in a roomy gray suit. That they had come together there in a small room in a modest hotel for a scientific consultation, and that, having discussed what was necessary, the subject was a work of many volumes, stubbornly continuing publication in Stuttgart, with long-standing cooperation of foreign specialists on separate groups of butterflies, they peaceably parted, each in his own direction. But this trip did not cheer him up. On the contrary, the constant dream weighing on him even increased its secret pressure. In the autumn, they returned to St. Petersburg. He worked strenuously on the fifth volume of Butterflies and Moths of the Russian Empire, went out rarely, and, fuming more at his opponent's blunders than at his own, played chess with the recently widowed botanist Berg. He would look through the daily papers with an ironical smile. He would take Tanya on his knees, then lapse into pensiveness, and his hand on Tanya's round shoulder would grow pensive too. Once in November, he was given a telegram at table. He unsealed it, read it to himself, read it again to judge by the second movement of his eyes, laid it aside, took a sip of port wine from a ladle-shaped goblet of gold, and imperturbably continued his conversation with a poor relative of ours, a little old man with freckles all over his skull who came to dinner twice a month and invariably brought Tanya soft, sticky toffees. Tyanushki. When the guests had departed, he sank into an armchair, took off his glasses, passed his palm from top to bottom over his face, and announced in an even voice that Uncle Alek had been dangerously wounded in the stomach by a grenade fragment while working at a first aid post under fire, and immediately there stood out in Fyodor's soul, tearing it with its sharp edges, one of those numberless, deliberately grotesque dialogues that the brothers had still so recently indulged in at table. Uncle Alek. Well, tell me, Kostya, did you ever happen to see on the V reservation the little bird so was? Father, curtly. I'm afraid I did not. Uncle Alek, warming up. And Kostya, did you never see Popovsky's horse stung by Popov's fly? Father, even more curtly. Never. Uncle Alek, completely ecstatic. And have you never had occasion, for example, to observe the diagonal motion of entoptic swarms? Father, looking him straight in the eye. I have. That same night, he set out for Galicia to get him, brought him back extremely quickly and comfortably, obtained the best of the best doctors, Gershenson, Yezhov, Miller-Melnitsky, and himself attended two protracted operations. By Christmas, his brother was well. And then something suddenly changed in Konstantin Kirillovich's mood. His eyes came to life and softened. One again heard that musical humming which he used to emit on the move when he was particularly pleased about something. He went off somewhere. Certain boxes arrived and departed. And in the house, around all this mysterious gaiety of the masters, one could sense a growing feeling of indefinite, expectant perplexity. And once, when Fyodor happened to be passing through the gilt reception hall, bathed in spring sunshine, he suddenly noticed the brass handle of the white door leading into Father's study jiggle, but not turn, as if someone was limply fingering it without opening the door. But then it quietly opened, and Mother came out with a vague, meek smile on her tear-stained face, making an odd gesture of helplessness as she went past Fyodor. He knocked on his father's door and entered the study. "What do you want?" asked Konstantin Kirillovich, without looking up or stopping writing. "Take me with you," said Fyodor. The fact that, at the most alarming time, when Russia's borders were crumbling and her inner flesh was being eaten away, Konstantin Kirillovich suddenly planned to abandon his family for 2 years for the sake of a scientific expedition into a remote country, struck most people as a wild caprice, a monstrous frivolity. There was even talk that the government would not permit purchase of provision, that the madman would get neither traveling companions nor pack animals. But no further away than in Turkestan, the peculiar smell of the epoch was hardly perceptible. Practically the only reminder of it was a reception organized by some district administrators to which the guests brought gifts to aid the war. A little later, a rebellion broke out among the Kyrgyz and the Cossacks in connection with the summons to do war work. Just before his departure, in June 1916, Godunov Cherdintsev came from town to Leshino to bid his family farewell. Until the very last minute, Fyodor dreamed that his father would take him with him. Once he had said he would do so as soon as his son was 15. "At any other time I would take you," he said now, as if forgetting that for him time was always another one. In itself, this last farewell was in no way different from preceding ones. After the orderly succession of embraces worked out by family custom, both parents, donning identical amber goggles with suede blinkers, settled themselves in a red touring car. All around stood the servants. Leaning on his stick, the old watchman remained at a distance by the lightning-split poplar. The driver, a short, fat, round little man in velveteen livery and orange gaiters, with a carroty nape and a topaz on his pudgy hand, straining horribly, jerked again, started the engine. Mother and father began to vibrate in their seats, got quickly behind the steering wheel, shifted a lever on it, pulled on his gauntlets, and turned his head. Konstantin Kirillovich gave him a pensive nod, and the car moved off. The fox terrier choked with barking as it squirmed wildly in Tanya's arms, turning over onto its back and twisting its head over her shoulder. The red back of the car disappeared round the bend, and then from behind the fir trees, on top of a rising whine, there sounded the sharp change of gears, followed by a comfortably receding murmur. All was still. But a few moments later, from the village beyond the river, came again the triumphant roar of the engine, which gradually faded away. Forever. Ivona Ivanovna, weeping profusely, went for some milk for the cat. Tanya, affecting to sing, returned to the cool, resonant, empty house. The shade of Jacques Sibai, who had died the preceding autumn, slipped off the porch bench and went back to its quiet, handsome paradise, rich in roses and sheep. Fyodor walked across the park, opened the tuneful wicket gate, and cut across the road where the thick tires had just imprinted their tracks. A familiar black-and-white beauty rose smoothly off the ground and described a wide circle, also taking part in the seeing off. He turned into the trees and came by way of a shady path where golden flies hung a quiver in transversal sunbeams to his favorite clearing, boggy, blooming, moistly glistening in the hot sun. The divine meaning of this wood meadow was expressed in its butterflies. Everyone might have found something here. The holiday maker might have rested on a stump. The artist might have screwed up his eyes. But its truth would have been probed somewhat deeper by knowledge-amplified love, by its wide-open orbs, to paraphrase Pushkin. Freshly emerged, and because of their fresh, almost orange coloration, merry-looking Cellini fritillaries floated with a kind of enchanting demureness on outstretched wings, flashing ever so rarely, like the fins on a goldfish. An already rather bedraggled but still powerful swallowtail, minus one spur, and flapping its panoply, descended on a chamomile, taking off as if backing from it, and the flower it left straightened up and started to sway. A few black-veined whites flew about lazily. One or two were spattered with blood-like pupil discharge, spots of which on the white walls of cities predicted to our ancestors the fall of Troy, plagues, earthquakes. The first chocolate Aphantopus ringlets were already fluttering with a bouncy, unsteady motion over the grass, and pale micros rose from it, immediately falling again. A blue and red burnet moth with blue antennae, resembling a beetle in fancy dress, was settled on a scabiosa in company with a midge. Hastily abandoning the meadow to alight on an alder leaf, a female cabbage butterfly, by means of an odd upturn of her abdomen and the flat spread of her wings, somewhat reminiscent of flattened back ears, informed her badly rubbed pursuer that she was already impregnated. Two violet-tinged coppers, their females were not yet out, tangled in lightning-swift flight in midair, zoomed, spinning one around the other, scrapping furiously, ascending ever higher and higher, and suddenly shot apart, returning to the flowers. An amandus blue, in passing, annoyed a bee. A dusky Freya fritillary flicked by among the salinas. A small hummingbird moth with a bumblebee's body and glass-like wings beating invisibly tried from the air a flower with its long proboscis, darted to another, and then to a third. All this fascinating life, by whose present blend one could infallibly tell both the age of the summer with an accuracy almost to within one day, the geographical location of the area, and the vegetal composition of the clearing, all this that was living, genuine, and eternally dear to him, Fyodor perceived in a flash, with one penetrating and experienced glance. Suddenly, he placed a fist against the trunk of a birch tree, and leaning on it, burst into tears. Although his father had no liking for folklore, he used to cite one remarkable Kyrgyz fairy tale. the only son of a great Khan, having lost his way during a hunt. Thus begin the best fairy tales, and thus end the best lives. Caught sight among the trees of something sparkling. Coming closer, he saw it was a girl gathering brushwood in a dress made of fish scales. However, he could not decide what precisely was sparkling so much, the girl's face or her clothing. Going with her to her old mother, the young prince offered to give her as bride money a nugget of gold the size of a horse's head. "No," said the girl, "but here, take this tiny bag. It's little bigger than a thimble, as you can see. Go and fill it." The prince, laughing, "Not even one," he said, "will go in," threw in a coin, threw in another, a third, and then all that he had with him. Extremely puzzled, he went off to consult his father. All his treasures, gathering public funds and everything, in the bag the good Khan threw, shook and listened, shook anew, threw in twice as much again, just a dingle in the drain. They summoned the old woman. "That," she said, "is a human eye. It wants to encompass everything in the world." Then she took a pinch of earth and filled up the bag immediately. The last reliable evidence concerning my father, not counting his own letters, I found in some notes by the French missionary and learned botanist Barrault, who in the summer of 1917 chanced to meet him in the mountains of Tibet near the village of Chetou. "I was amazed to see," writes Barrault, Exploration Catholique for 1923, "a saddled white horse grazing in a mountain meadow. Presently a man in European dress appeared, descending from the rocks. He greeted me in French, and turned out to be the famous Russian traveller Godunov. I had not seen a European for over 8 years. We passed several delightful minutes on the sward in the shade of a rock, discussing a fine nomenclatorial point in connection with the scientific name of a tiny light blue iris which grew in the vicinity, and then, exchanging an amicable farewell, we parted, he to his companions calling him from a ravine, and I to Father Martin, dying in a remote hostelry. Beyond this, there is fog. Judging by my father's last letter, brief as usual, but unusually alarmed, which was delivered to us by a miracle at the beginning of 1918, he was preparing, soon after he met Barrault, to make the return journey. Having heard of the revolution, he asked us in it to move to Finland, where our aunt had a country house, and he wrote that, according to his calculations, he would be home with the maximum haste by the summer. We waited 2 summers for him, until the winter of 1919. We lived some of the time in Finland and some in St. Petersburg. Our house had long since been plundered, but Father's museum, the heart of the house, as if retaining the invulnerability inherent in sacred objects, survived whole, later coming under the jurisdiction of the Academy of Sciences. And this joy completely compensated for the demise of chairs and tables familiar since childhood. We lived in St. Petersburg in 2 rooms in grandmother's flat. For some reason or other, she was twice taken off for questioning. She caught cold and died. A few days after that, on one of those terrible winter evenings, hungry and hopeless, which played such an ominously close part in the civil disorder, an unknown youth visited me, in pince-nez, unprepossessing and uncommunicative, and asked me to call immediately on his uncle, the geographer Berezovsky. He did not know, or did not want to say, what for. But suddenly, everything somehow crumbled inside me, and I began to live mechanically. Nowadays, several years later, I sometimes meet this Misha in the Russian bookshop in Berlin where he works, and every time I see him, although we talk little, I feel a hot shiver run down the whole of my spinal column, and my whole being relives our brief road together. My mother was not there when this Misha came. This name I shall also remember forever. But we met her on our way downstairs. Not knowing my companion, she anxiously asked where I was going. I replied I was going for some hair clippers, of which we had happened to be speaking a few days beforehand. Later, I often dreamed about them, those non-existent clippers, which took the most unexpected forms. Mountains, landing stages, coffins, hand organs. But I always knew with a dreamer's instinct that it was clippers. "Wait," cried my mother, but we were already downstairs. We walked along the street quickly and silently, he slightly ahead of me. I looked at the masks of the houses, at the humps of the snowdrifts, and I tried to outwit fate by imagining to myself, and thus destroying its possibility in advance, the still uncomprehended black, fresh grief which I would carry back home. We entered a room which I recall as being completely yellow, and there an old man with a pointed beard, wearing a field jacket and jackboots, informed me without preamble that, according to still unverified information, my father was no longer living. Mother was waiting for me below on the street. During the next 6 months, until Uncle Aliek almost forcibly took us abroad, we tried to find out how and where he had perished, and indeed whether he had perished at all. Apart from the fact that it happened in Siberia is a big place, on the return journey from Central Asia, we found out nothing at all. Can it be that they hid from us the place and circumstances of his mysterious death and have continued to hide them to this day? His biography in the Soviet Encyclopedia ends simply with the words, "He died in 1919. Or did the contradictoriness of the vague evidence truly rule out any explicitness in their answers? Once in Berlin, we learned one or two supplementary things from various sources and from various people, but these supplements turned out to be nothing but new layers of uncertainty rather than glimpses through it. Two shaky versions, both more or less of a deductive nature, and telling us nothing, moreover, about the most important point, how exactly did he die, if he died, were entangled in one another and mutually contradictory. According to one of them, news of his death was brought to Semipalatinsk by a Kyrgyz. According to the other, it was brought by a Cossack to Akpulat. What was my father's route? Was he going from Semirechye to Omsk by way of the Feathergrass steppe with a guide on a piebald pony, or from the Pamirs to Orenburg through the Turgay region by way of the sandy steppe with the guide on a camel, he himself on a horse, birch bark stirruped, from well to well, avoiding villages and railway lines?